You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. And welcome to Writers' Voices here on KRUU, our solar-powered, local, grassroots, open-source community radio station. And it's a beautiful snowy day in March. We have every kind of weather that you would ever want to see. You'll find in Iowa in March. So today we have a heavy, wet snow. If you're listening on Friday, if you're listening to Writers' Voices on Monday morning at 8 a.m. when we're rebroadcast, I hope you have a nice, bright, sunny day ahead. So I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and the snow kept Caroline from joining us today. She made it halfway over here from Mount Pleasant and decided she needed to turn around and go back before it got too bad. So I'm flying solo today, but I have a very special guest with us today in the studio. Kakendra Poon, the author of Nauli Cried in the Himalayas, A Journey That We Each Take in Life, and a subtitle, Songs of Humanity. Kakendra is also the creator of the documentary film A Lost Village in the Himalayas. He was born and raised in a small village, 6,700 feet up in the Himalayan mountains, and somehow made his way from there to Fairfield, Iowa, and we're going to find out exactly how that happened. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Kakendra.
Thank you. Namaste to everybody.
So let's start with how you come to be in Fairfield.
It's surprisingly, I was actually in Fairfield, Iowa in 1998. When I first self-published my book, I had a friend who lived here in Fairfield, Joe and Marty Connors, and they invited actually me to come down here and meet a teacher, English teacher from Maharishi University, to see if she would help me to edit. And that's how I ended up coming to Fairfield in 1998. And then after that, basically I recently, after I published my seventh edition of my book, I couldn't find a job in California. So I decided to take a trip wherever my spirit would guide me to find a job. So through the internet, I found a waiter's job in Des Moines, and I took myself almost 2,300 miles of driving journey, and then it went on, and from the waiter's job lasted only 3 to 4 months, and then after that, I kept searching for another job and ended up getting a job in Coralville, and then ended up getting a job in Washington, Iowa.
So you were getting closer every
yes.
step.
And then when I actually lost my job in Washington, Iowa at a factory, I didn't know where to go. And somehow my spirit called me that, you know, this was the place. When I first published my book, that's how I had ended up in Fairfield. And I knew the Fairfield existed so beautifully with all the community efforts. I knew people were nice, and the whole aura of this Fairfield's the creative side was always inspiring me. So I decided in between my job hunting and my progress with my editing my film and book, I just decided I would move down to Fairfield. That's how it's been almost 9 months I've been here in Fairfield.
Well, welcome to Fairfield. We're glad to have you.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Now, your journey started not in California, but halfway across the world.
Yes, yes.
So could you tell us a little bit about the village you grew up in and how you came to come to the States?
Absolutely, absolutely. I grew up in a small village called Ulleri, which is about 8 hours walk further west from the closest town called Pokhara in the western part of Nepal. It's actually our village lies right on the pathway of a famous trekking route called Annapurna Trekking Route. And for me, you know, growing up in the village and completely soaked with the community and the love, morality, the genuity and the sincerity and honesty of people. And I was inspired from very early in my childhood. And then the culture that, you know, in the mountain village is so beautiful that I basically somehow having this dream when I started seeing many Western tourists come through our village. I was always interested in where they're coming from and how do they think as a human being, and what do they think overall in life? What do they think about as a creature, as a human being versus the Mother Earth? And so, and the fact that seeing all these tourists wearing nice boots, shoes, and hats, and jackets, and bright raincoats, I was really intrigued because at home, you know, my mother couldn't even afford to buy me a pant or a shoes or a jacket. So I always thought of having those stuff that tourists had. And so that's when, actually, when I encountered the Western tourists coming through our village, I was very fortunate that I would, every so often, you know, when I had no school supplies like pens and notebooks, I would stand at the side of the road in our village and wait for tourists. And when they would come, I would stretch my hands and ask them pens or notebook, please, balloons. And so I was very lucky. I got, they offered me time to time as a gift, and that's how I was. I have always been inspired. The fact that my journey happened to be this way to America. And that's my, then seeing so many tourists, actually that's when I had started realizing that life is beyond I could, you know, I was thinking. And so I realized, and then when I started dreaming about the village, when I started basically watching the tourist, I just told to myself, you know, my dream is to go out there in the Western world and see how people really live. And I was dreaming about coming to, you know, such advanced nations like European nations like America, I thought dream is something each one of us can afford, and it's not expensive, and that's what the first perspective I had. And I said to myself, well, I'll dream for now, even though my mom cannot buy me a bowl of rice, I can still dream. So, and I knew at that time, I knew that I would make my dream come true. And so it happened that I was basically waiting for the alignment of my dreams to kind of connect me to further in my towards my future. And actually in 1985, when my brother, one of my older brother, a modern Poon, he got a job in the capital city, Kathmandu, and while he was working for an American friend, he actually gave me an opportunity to study in Kathmandu. And when I promised him that I would study hard and I would make my future better.
And how old were you then when you went to Kathmandu?
When I left the village, I was about 12 years old. And I went to Kathmandu, and my brother put me in three different boarding schools. And that's where actually I started learning English. And English has been one of my favorite subjects. And so I was actually from the time that he brought me to Kathmandu, and seeing the life so different in Kathmandu, the people, the culture completely different from the village, I actually was missing the village. And because everything was so compacted, the civilization was far beyond the village, the simplicity. So actually my writing literally started when the fact that I left the village, living in the capital city and seeing the life so different there, I basically missing home, I started writing.
About the village.
Yes, about all the life that how we were living and connection of people, humanity, the morality and everything. So
right. Did you ever go back to live in the village after you left?
Yes. Basically, I would study in the boarding schools, and then in between during the vacations, I would be going back and forth to the village. Okay. Yes.
And then, when did you leave Nepal?
That's one of the biggest stepping stone question for me. In 1990, just after when I finished my high school, and actually in Nepal the high school level ends at 10th grade, versus 12th here in America. So I had just finished my high school, and I ended up returning to the village to see my mother, and I was returning with my brother, older brother, and when I was back in our village, one of my cousins had his wedding ceremony taking over in further up in different village, which is actually also a Pune village, called Sikha. Then I was one of the basically a guest. I was going up there with my cousins and my brothers and friends. We were heading up further up, and about 5 or 6 hours later, I just below Gorepani, which is the very famous mountain in Annapurna trekking route, I actually happened to meet a Western couple, and this guy and girl were resting on a side of the road, and I mean, for somehow I knew I had to be friend. So I, as all my friends and brothers, they left, they passed by, I decided I would just stop and shake my hand with the tourist, and I introduced myself. And after talking for a while, this friend happened to be from America, and his name is Steve Wright. So after talking to Steve Wright for a while, he told me and Steve Wright was with his girlfriend from England, Kathy. So after talking with Steve for a while, he then let me know about his difficulties, that somebody had cheated him in Kathmandu, and somebody actually told him and his girlfriend that they would set up a trek somewhere in the country, but they never did. They took their money and then basically left. And so they were, my friend Steve Wright, who I'm talking about, he was getting short of cash. And I told him not to worry. You know, I said to him, don't worry, my brother is in Kathmandu. He can help you out. We can help you. That's what we do in the village anyway. So he was really thrilled. And just before I left, and then he, out of curiosity, I asked him where he was from, and he said, I'm from America. And I told him one of my dreams is to go to America to study in high school. And I just had to throw all that, because I knew in my deep down my heart, I just needed to find one individual that can see my heart and understand my feeling and help me out somehow. So, because my overall dream is not just for my own sake of future, but rather to basically return to the village and help village community in overall, from rather than seeing the culture and people without hope. So, I told my friend Steve Wright that my dream to come to America, and I actually, just before we departed, we exchanged our telephone number, and I got his hotel's telephone number, that we decided to meet in Kathmandu a week later, and and that's exactly what we did. After a week later, I left the village. I was so excited, and I knew I couldn't miss this friend. So I returned back to the Kathmandu, and I met him, and I took my brother with me, my older brother with me, and I introduced to Steve Wright, and we become good friends. And during another couple of weeks of stay, Steve, basically we fed Steve. He came and lived in our apartment, and we fed him, and we gave him some money. My brothers, they helped him. And that was right at the time when Nepal, we were struggling with the democracy. Mm-hmm. And that was actually the first time when we achieved democracy in 1991, but that was the same time when there was a chaos in Nepal. So I remember one night when I was taking my friend to his hotel room, and we had to survive through the rocks and bricks that were thrown out from the top of the roofs of people's houses, and then armies shooting the guns, and we had to run in between that. And I remember my friend Steve, he was really funny. He's one of the activists, very, very much activist, where he's the kind of person, he just had so much humor, and, you know, and he doesn't like anything he doesn't believe. He just goes out there and raises his hand. He doesn't care about anything else. But so I kind of loved his humor and the fact that, yeah, he was laughing when in between that chaos in Nepal that night. And I thought to myself, man, this friend is great. So he left actually just a week before the chaos ended, political chaos ended in Nepal, and when we got our democracy, just a week before that, my friend returned to America. And after that, you know, I didn't hear from him for about 3-4 months. I had been trying to admit myself to college through my brother's help, and then all of a sudden one day, actually on the 5th month, 5 months later, I got a letter from America at my brother's office, and when I actually saw the letter, I didn't know who it was from. I saw the name there, Judith Wright, but I didn't know it wasn't for me, but somehow I said, this is not for me. It's a completely unknown person. But when I opened the letter, it was Steve's mother, Judith Wright. That was amazing. And she wrote me in the letter that she had heard a lot about me through Steve Wright, and then Steve had told her almost all about me and my dreams. And for the next 6 months, I was able to correspond with Judith Wright, and she found a committee at Los Gatos Church, and they all decided to, you know, just sponsor me and just bring me down here to America. That's how actually I ended up coming to America. I landed in San Francisco on August 29th, 1991.
Wow. You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Kakundra Poon, author of Nauli Cried in the Himalayas, A Journey That We Each Take in Life. And this is a memoir about his life and how, you know, from the village at 6,700 feet up in the mountains in Nepal to, I don't know where the book ends exactly. How far does this take us?
the book will come down to 20 years, 2 decades of my journey in America.
Wow.
Just the last job. My book ends with the last job, how I lost it, and now how I am back to the zero again.
You're back to what again?
Back to zero again,
back
financially.
Back to zero again. You've come around in a circle then.
Absolutely. Yes. I think that's why I appreciate life, because, you know, I never take it for granted, because everything is, life is beautiful, and no matter what happens, I always just try to keep the best positive attitude and just move on, and then something that always things comes out right.
Well, Kakundra, would you explain the title of the book to me?
Absolutely, absolutely, Monica. This, you know, it took me, by the way, this book, this is my 7th edition of my book.
And it's changed each time? Have you updated it?
Oh, absolutely. For the 7th, until the 6th edition of my book, my book first published in 1998, from 1998 to 2003, I had my edition, 6th edition. And they were all sold in basically the format of, what do you call it, is the 8.5 by 11 size of book format. It's not even a book format, but what do you call, manuscript.
Okay.
I sold almost 6,000 manuscript.
So you didn't actually have it printed as a book?
No. I couldn't afford it, and then I couldn't find any publisher to help me out. So I worked at a print companies here and there, and then the managers, they helped me out to print my book, and I would just pay for the paper. And so that's, but I believed in that I would, for a long run, I had to do that. And so after selling almost 6,000 copies, without advertising, it's one person at a time on the road in between all the struggle of my job and place to live. And in 2004, I printed actually my seventh edition on a paperback version, 1,000 copies, under the title called The Bridge Between Human Spirits. Mm-hmm. And so basically last seventh edition of my books, my book has been published under the title The Bridge Between Human Spirits. And for a long time, actually, I had been having this very much thoughts that in order for me to appeal to the bigger audience and in order to portray the real silence, beauty, and of the culture of the village, not only about our village community, but the culture of all villages in Nepal, I had to do something that touches every human heart. So that's when actually it's since 2004. It's been almost eight years. Since for the last 8 years, I had been truly been thinking about the title. And so when I actually just when I lost my job at a factory in Washington, Iowa, I then decided, you know, maybe the God is doing it right. You know, the factory job was very stressing, and the people were not considered as a human being, and it was terrible. People were mistreated and disrespected, and the vibe was terrible. And but I had, you know, working over 55 different companies around in America, I had already seen all that. But for me, the last place the factory was when the supervisor started being very abusive, verbally abusive and violent, and I just had to get up and say, you know, it's time for me to get away from such situation where one can have really unhealthy life. But it's too bad many people can't get out of it. But right. For me, it's easy. It's been always easy. I just said, okay, that's enough. I'm out of here. So when I left, I had one thing in my mind. I said, okay, I'm going to use my time. I still don't have a job. I'm still looking for it. But in the meantime, actually, the losing that job gave me a really beautiful life. And I put together the very same book that The Bridge Between Human Spirits, that seventh edition I had published in 2004. And last copy I sold was just 7 months ago, last piece that I had left. And so ever since the 2004, what I had been doing is I had tried consulting with many editors. Actually, over three or four editors I went through, but it never worked out. I mean, for me, you know, when I got my book after being edited by different individual editors, I somehow didn't find my voice in the book. Mm. It was so more like perfect English, and that's not me. You know, I don't have a perfect English, and I will never have perfect English because I'm actually a villager, and I'm a Nepali mountain villager. You know, I took care of the buffaloes, and I'm a shepherd, buffalo shepherd, people can call me. And I think I realized actually that, you know, having anybody edit my stories wasn't going to reflect the true meaning of my existence, what I'm trying to portray about my journey and on people who that I meet and the people who I love and people, it's the beauty of the human life. So, and I just realized, but anyway, since 2004, then after the last paperback version, I was inspired by many many teachers and friends who guided me and saying, you know, nobody else can edit your book except you yourself. You are the best editor, you know. Mm-hmm. Nobody can see what you see. So why don't you go ahead and just keep doing it? Just keep editing on your own and just put your heart and soul, you know. And so that's what I've been doing for the last 8 years. I just went over my book probably over 100 times. I wrote the book literally over 100 times, rewriting all over again, and kept shaping and shaping. And actually, for me, writing, I mean, I actually got this joke where somehow people, I had heard this, somebody said, you know, writing is not a writing. What it is rewriting.
Right, exactly.
So I thought I got that joke, and I said, boy, it's nobody can write the book to begin with perfect. It takes up many years of experiences, you know. It's a lot of hard work. And so for me, it's like, so when I lost my job just recently in 2011, April, then I decided, well, I decided I would give my book the title that it deserves in overall humanity perspective. So I said, newly cried in Himalayas. The fact I said newly cried in the Himalayas, so a lot of people thought that newly is, they, people couldn't figure out what newly is, and they thought somebody is, it's a human's name of a human being. So actually newly is a type of bird that is found in mountain villages, and especially in the western part of Nepal. This newly is a bird that sings throughout the winter. It's really beautiful, and it's like they it turns out that they tend not to appear in front of human beings at all. And if we can hear from miles and miles away, it's that beauty of like being able to hear this newly birds in a far away, in a far distance, and you stand by the side of the road and you start hearing that newly bird. It really gives you that pure innocence of your life, and you start realizing you lived, you had just lived 1,000 years behind, and you are living 1,000 years ahead. And for me, growing up in the mountain village, this you know, I didn't realize the true inspiration of my life, seeing this life as a beautiful life, a beautiful world, and it's like humanity wise it's like it had soaked my soul into the mountain, the freedom of life in the mountain village. So the newly birds for me has been an inspiration, a symbol, and I didn't realize that actually even I took 20 years of my journey away from the village. And yet, you wouldn't believe it, but I was subconsciously, I was hearing this newly bird in my ears every moment of my life, even the 20 years being away from the village. And I realized, wow, this is who I am, you know, this is who I am, and this should be what my work, what it is. And the bird deserves its story. The bird deserves their story. And so this title actually, yeah, that's how I realized, you know, it's for me, newly these birds have been the inspiration of my life, and this very same newly birds have inspired thousands of travelers and thousands of villagers all throughout the past decades, you know.
Now, have you seen the newly bird? Or
in fact, I have come to pretty close incident where I was trying to capture through my video camera just 2 years ago, but it happened that there was a little boy from the bottom of, from the side of the road, he was stretching his swing gun.
Okay.
And I didn't realize that he was stretching his swing gun, and I was trying to capture the bird through my video camera. Just when I was close enough, he threw his rocks and the bird flew away. But I have seen pretty close, but not really clearly. So it actually looks.
How large a bird is it?
The bird actually is the size of a parrot.
Wow.
It's the size of a parrot, I think. And the fact that before, I don't want to confuse with a newly, the bird, I gave the title is a female, because newly, Lee, when we add newly, a newl is the, we call it the for the male.
Okay.
Male bird, newl. Because the reason why it's, The newl is people because the way how the bird sings is they call, I mean the birds, if you hear it, if you actually come to Nepal, you will hear the sound called like this, newl, 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 newl. It's how that sound comes.
Okay.
But actually, I always thought that was, I mean, for all my life, I had never been able to find out the difference whether it's sang by the male or female. But recently, 2 years ago, I actually got to understand the female actually the one that is been singing the whole time I had been listening in the village. The female sings, unbelievably, what I found out is the male newly bird sits right beside her and rhymes with her. It's like the female will be doing noo noo and the male will be doing cook cook cook. So in between that noo cook noo cook, it's amazing. No, I just found out that, Monica. It's like, wow, that's amazing.
Wow.
But from like miles away, you don't hear the male because male is giving the actually maybe male is, it's amazing. Male, I think what it is doing is, it's helping the bird to keep up the rhythm.
Okay,
but
it's the rhythm section.
Yeah, so we don't hear it, but
we
hear the female.
And the lead singer.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
But I mean, it's when you hear it, this bird, you will never forget it. Once it comes to your ear, it just stays there, unbelievable.
You're listening to Writer's Voices. I'm Monica Hadley, and with me today is Kakendra Poon, the author of Newly Cried in the Himalayas, which we just heard who Newly is, the female Newly bird that
yes.
was the song of his childhood. And does this bird live anywhere else in the world, or is this the only place where the Newly bird lives?
You know, surprisingly, actually, I have a friend of mine said, you know what, let me see if I can Google the bird Newly and see what it comes out. He checked it and there's nothing else come in, because I think I haven't personally seen its definition of this bird. So that's why I have actually done my 3 or 4 paragraph of giving the definition of this bird on through my own soul. So hopefully that will give the readers to understand what this really bird really means.
Now, Kakendra, you also have a film, a documentary film called
yes.
The Lost Village in the Himalayas. Is it also the story of your life, or is it different? Is it the film version of the book, or is it something different?
So the film actually is centered with the beauty, the culture of our village life, actually, how we live in our mountain village. It's in for the past 13 years, I've been going back and forth filming. Actually, after writing the book, one thing always sit in my heart said, you know, I have to, if I wrote the book, now I have to show the film while the culture still exists. So I have dedicated last 13 years basically going back and forth filming, you know, scratching my own pocket money. And I wanted to share this story of the beauty of the culture.
What is life like in the village now? Has it changed since in the 20 years you've been gone?
Absolutely. I mean, it's been a lot of changes, and that's the same problem, good and bad changes as it goes all around the world. And for me, being able to perceive that such a beautiful culture, the honesty, the sincerity, and the hardworking ethics and the morality, all that, seeing that in growing up in the village with it, and after being away from home, it has been painful because seeing so many villagers, you know, village people leave the village, you know, ultimately with the idea of going out in this modern civilization and making millions of dollars and driving Hummer and Mercedes-Benz. And people have this idea to that they can live a fantastic life. So this is kind of an illusion that I had. Mm-hmm. I have been noticing since it's from my own true experience. Personally, I miss a lot because this village is where I'm supposed to be. Mm-hmm. But it's just that I came further and further away from the village, but in my heart, the village is still in my heart. But yeah, there's so many changes. So many people have been leaving the villages, have left the villages, thinking that their lives should be better somewhere else.
And are they?
Oh, no. I mean, it's out there. They don't have anybody. No culture. I mean, they don't have anybody to get, you know, get support and help. Like, whereas in the village, you know, whenever we have trouble, we have the elders. The elders take care of the youngers. Elders is the one, they guide everybody. And we don't, we have everything what we needed. So seeing that, and the culture-wise, all these dances, the ceremony, and all sorts of sort of traditional things, the fact that the young people, I mean, now, in the two decades, the younger generation is not able to learn and not able to cope it because they are in the realm of this, what do you call it, is a fantastic life. Like, and the sad part is in mountain villages. I mean, it's today, they have TV now. So that because of the TV, they can click the 75 different channels, and then they will be watching the Hollywood garbages, and they will be watching what do you call this? There's a one channel that comes where it's nothing but fashion shows, and all this junk advertisement, the false information. That which is too bad because it's you know, when you are throwing such TV and garbages and false information in the TV, I mean, is the, all these innocent village people, what how are they going to cope with it? And they can't really cope in a positive way because what they see, basically for them what they see is they believe that that's what the real life is. Unfortunately, you know, unless people you know, get the education, they don't know. So it's been sad because now you see, instead of communicating and talking to families and relatives, people are clicking the channels and just staring at the on the screen like monkeys. It's been sad.
So are you trying to inform people in the villages that it isn't all, you know, that the roads aren't all paved with gold in America and it's not all perfect? And are you trying to take that message back? And if you do, do they say, well, then why are you still living there?
You know, that's absolutely, that's a good question, absolutely. And I think people are, you know, my return back in the village several times has been a good thing because most of them had this illusion that the fact that I've been in America for so long, and they thought I would have a big house and the best cars and tons of money, but they realized later, you know, as I'm returning home with bare hand and my bare-bone feet, and just being a villager, you know, and returning back home with nothing, and since. The fact of the matter is, materialistically, I don't have not much. I never collected not much. I wasn't into making money and be myself rich. That wasn't my idea, you know, because life is really short. This physical life, this one life for right now is very short. And realizing that, I mean, as a child, I knew I have to do something good in this lifetime while I'm physically here and spiritually here, so that I can still continue my journey spiritually for the long run. So, I mean, actually, the fact that people, see me now going back and forth in the village, and I told them, you know, I wrote the story about our village life, how beautiful we had life, you know, that we cannot get in outside in different places after we leave the village. So I've been, with my return to the village and the fact that I have done so much run around with my little camera to take the footage of the village life. People, I think, have got, you know, people have been inspired and got the perception that, you know, this guy, the way he's been away from home for almost 20 years, but yet this guy is nothing but just a simple village guy. He loves the village and he wants to show the story about our village life. He doesn't require a best watch, or he doesn't require a tie and suit, but he's just a good guy, you know. And so I think that's what people are being able to see that. And with that token, my goal is basically to show that, you know, we can live in the village, and we don't really have to leave the village. You know, and we don't need to leave the village because this is where we grew up, and this is where we can nurture the Mother Earth. This is where we can grow things. this is where we can play and sing and dance like we did before. So there's no reason for us to chase after the Mercedes-Benz and $2 million. That doesn't even exist there.
Now, in the villages, do people have the basic necessities met? Do they have enough to eat? Do they have shelter, clothing, you know? Or is survival difficult there?
You know, absolutely, absolutely, Monica. The fact of the matter is, in the villages, people have home. They have stone houses that keeps them warm. They have lands to grow food. They have, water, free water from Mother Earth, spring water, fresh water. There's nobody have to pay for any, for the water. And there's no such thing called bills. People don't have to pay no bills. People grow their own vegetables. And you harvest and nurture your own land. And if you don't have something, you need to exchange. We exchange things. And in fact, growing up in the village, we had very best potatoes in our village. And during the potato season, there was a different ethnic group of people from further down south. They would, these ladies would come with their guava, the fruit guava, and in their basket. And when they would come to our village, and then they would trade in their guava with potatoes. And boy, I loved it. The moment they would show up, we would dive in, and then we would trade in the potatoes with their guavas. And it was such a fantastic culture. And I thought, that was the beauty. That was the beauty what I had seen. So seeing that all kind of blur away is like, wow, that's one of the elements that what I'm talking,
Right. But of course, there are a lot of things like you wanted pens and notebooks and things such as that that you weren't able to make or obtain in the village. Is there a way to maintain that the subsistence lifestyle, growing your own food, making most of the things you need, and yet still be able to obtain the things that truly are beneficial in modern society, such as antibiotics and medicines and pens and paper and things like that? Is tourism a way to do that?
Well, absolutely, yes. Yeah. I definitely believe that tourism is one of the most fundamental help in the whole Nepal's in overall in Nepal's economic growth. I think what's really problem, I think, is in the fact that the villagers have basic necessity, basically a home, land, friends, community to support them. And basically, I guess in the 2 decades, what has really affected is the fact that now that this new generation, young people, don't want to grow crops as our sisters or my mother's, our parents did. Because it's being basically what that makes it, the young people are being lazy. And I shouldn't say maybe lazy, but they are brainwashed by the media that they really have this idea where they can really go out there and, to different countries and sell their house, land. Many of them don't even sell it, can't sell it, nobody buys it, so they will just leave it and never come back. Wow. And they will sell their the goats or buffaloes. And in our country, that's the chaos. In the last 2 decades, I think 90% of all villagers have left and walked away from their villages. And in fact, now the people who are living in these mountain villages are people who had never thought about living, but they just so this is kind of good for these people. The newcomers is good because they were having a hard time somewhere else in the country, mm-hmm. and then when all these villagers left their homes, they went and lived there. So now they got the better life. So those people who left their really good home, Now they're in trouble. They have to worry about paying bills, electric bills. They have to worry about this and that. So it's just like kind of interesting.
Okay,
way.
But I have to ask for you. Why don't you go back and live in the village?
Absolutely. That's no. I would, and I am going to go back in the village. Yes, and there's nothing actually that satisfy me in this modern civilization other than one dream, one goal that I'm only reason why I'm in America or I would be in any Western civilization would be to share my story and promote my book and film so this can be truly be an inspiration for other individuals and human beings who struggle like I have struggled for the last 20 years in America trying to survive. So I think that would be the only reason why I am actually in America, just to share this story. And I think this life is short, and I think people, all people deserves the chance to get better.
Well, Kakendra, if someone wants to see the movie, A Lost Village in the Himalayas, how would they see this? Are you going to be showing this here in Fairfield?
Yes, I am actually, I will be showing the film tomorrow night at Bert
Chinowski's.
Yes, his home.
So that would be Saturday, March 3rd?
Yes, okay. At 7:30, I believe.
Okay.
And I will be screening my film at the public library in here in Fairfield on March 10th at 6 p.m.
Okay.
And so I have done that scheduling.
Great.
So people are welcome to come and please join and watch this beautiful film. And people can also, you know, if people don't have time, I know a lot of, you know, we all take different journey in life. That's why I loved putting that title, subtitle, you know, we all take different, none of us as a human being have the same journey we take. So actually I have a website where, you know, people can contact me or they can order my book through 1-800 number. Or they can order my book and film. Actually, the name of my simple website I created, it's called a project, www.projecthimalayanhope.org. And again, www.projecthimalayanhope.org. And my 800 number, actually, people can call and I can pick up the phone, is 1-888-914-6636. And again, 1-888-914-6636. Actually, this is my 1-800 number where people can call me anytime.
Great. Now, is the book available on Amazon or any of the other bookstores?
I wish it was, but I have never been able to put in Amazon yet. And basically, this book I'm selling one copy at a time from my little car.
So you've got copies printed already?
Yes, yes, I have. Oh, yes.
Yes.
I printed 500 copies just last week.
Wow.
So.
We are listening to Writers' Voices. I'm Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Kakendra Poon, author of Newly Cried in the Himalayas, A Journey That We Each Take in Life. Kakendra, we don't have a lot of time left. Would you mind reading a couple of stories from your book?
Oh, absolutely.
For our audience?
So out of all this many pages, where would you want me to go?
Well, let's do something from your childhood, and then maybe something from after, if we have time, something from after you came to America.
Yes. So, for example...
While he's looking for that, I'll remind our listeners.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The subtitle is called "Beginning of My Dream." One rainy summer, early evening, I was running up the hill towards our village from our cornfield in Nepane. The monsoon's rain had been pouring all day long. As I got to Padera, right below our village, I saw a tourist slowly walking up in a bright yellow raincoat. I started running up faster. When I got close to her, I said, "Namaste," joining both of my hands in front of my face. By then, I was completely soaked. As she looked at me and with a smile, I said, "Namaste, pen, pencils, balloons." I lifted my hands towards her. While the sky thundered, taking out some sweets from her backpack, "Here," she handed them to me. In a hurry, opening plastic cover of one of it, I quickly put in my mouth and started rolling back and forth. She kept looking at me with admiration, while grinding it hard with a smile. "You English?" I asked. "No, I'm an American," she replied. "Where America?" I asked her, looking towards the sky. It is far away," she said, pointing towards the southern mountains. "Oh, far away," I nodded. For a while, I thought maybe she meant in some other planet or universe. I didn't know where she meant, but I knew I could get there one day. Just when she started walking up again, joining both my hands, I said to her, "Namaste." I really meant to thank her. "Bye-bye," she waved and continued on her journey while clouds danced around the valley. I stood on the edge of Pandera and began dreaming about going to America.
Okay, and now how about a section from after you arrived in America when you were in high school? I was reading some of the things about high school.
In high school in America.
Yes, and while he's looking for that, I'll remind our listeners that if you missed any part of this interview and would like to hear it, we rebroadcast Monday morning at 8 a.m. If you're listening to Monday, you can check for it on the web at writersvoices.com and KRUUFM.com. It usually takes us about a week to get the interviews posted on the websites. And we're happy to have you download and listen there.
Here, Monica, can I read this piece called... in between my high school, I was as a senior, I got this job at a McDonald's. So this title is called McDonald's and Me. Just when I started riding on my new bicycle, I got a job at McDonald's on Los Gatos Boulevard. After watching about 2 hours of videotape about the history of McDonald's, the manager, the Roger, handed me the uniform. After I put it on, Roger took me to the register and started showing me how to take customers' orders. My trainer was a lady in her 40s, but she was starting to drive me nuts. I would be taking an order from a customer, but she would ask me to get drinks for her. I didn't know where the cups were and which drinks were which. While trying to get soda, she would ask me to get fries. She didn't just ask me to get things. She literally pulled my hands right and left. And Scott was another supervisor, and he was a fun person to work with. Throughout my shift, I would take orders. What amazed me the most was the people never stopped coming. Sometimes I thought, don't people in America know how to cook or what? The trouble was that the people didn't just order food. They wanted half and half fries in separate bags, extra ketchup in side cups, burger with two different cheeses, no onions, extra hot coffee with no cream, on and on. I used to stand there, my God, to make it worse. Oh yeah, can you make two items to go and five for here? Then my trouble was to figure out which items were which. Even though I was trying hard, they said I wasn't working fast enough, so they gave my final check and I had to leave.
Is that the first time you got fired from a
job? That's right, absolutely. That was my great experience.
But you had some positive experiences at your high school, it sounds like.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yes. No, I did. When somebody stole my bicycle that I had worked that summer, and the principal, the Mr. Vlasic, he had somehow heard about my loss of my bicycle, and so one day, all the teachers from the high school, they invited me to a room, and when I showed up there, surprisingly, they had bought a bicycle to me for my sake. And it was beautiful. I had a tears in my eyes, and they said, you know, we care about you. You know, we don't want you to think that everybody's bad in America. And so that was very nice of them.
Well, Kakendra, thank you so much for joining us today on Writers' Voices. We're about out of time.
Absolutely. Thank you, Monica.
Bert Chinaski is screening your movie Saturday, March 3rd at 7:30. People can contact him for more information about that. Or March 10th at the Fairfield Public Library at 6 p.m.
Yes.
And you want to say the 800 number one more time?
Yes. People can go to the projecthimalayanhope.org, and inside will be my 1-800 number will be 1-888-914-6636. One more time, 1-888-914-6636. Please, anybody likes to find out about my book, please give me a call.
And stay tuned now for Planet Erstwhile. James Moore has a whole show up and ready, running from Canada. He's got it all ready for you to go. And as always, he'll have a number of really exciting guests and lots of music. And see you next week on Writers' Voices. Our guest next week is Michael Schumann, who writes about investing in local business from a national perspective. And so we're excited about that. See you next week, and thanks for tuning in.
Thank you, Monica.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.